From Virginia to Texas, Ohio to Oklahoma, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration is putting its finger on the scales of voter registration in the lead up to the 2024 presidential election. Ken Cuccinelli from the Election Transparency Initiative is here with details. There were several high-profile races in states across the country this past week. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on results in Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Ballot questions in Maine and Colorado revealed a conservative streak among voters in those Democrat-leaning states. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights has survived yet another attempt on its life. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. With concerns over the integrity of the 2020 presidential election still lingering, the Biden administration is already muddying the waters for 2024. Ken Cuccinelli is national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. He is here to explain. Ken, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ken, going back to the beginning of this, President Biden issued an executive order really requiring certain elements of the federal government to tinker in the voter registration process. Want to fill us in on those details?
He issued an executive order, I want to say 2 months in maybe to his administration. It was always described the way in Happy Talk. Make voting easier was the typical description. But really what they were doing was trying to convert parts of the federal government into voter turnout machines, voter registration and turnout efforts. And of course, those are going to be targeted at areas, whether geographically or programmatically in the government, that are going to be more Democratic, by which I mean Democrat Party voters. At least that's what they assume. And they're turning the government from a neutral arbiter in this competition of ideas into an active participant on the side of the Democratic National Committee. That's what this executive order is about. Executive Order 14019 is the number. It's playing out more or less as those of us opposed to it said it would. And by the way, they're hiding their plans every step of the way. And that tells you something, too.
It was my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that elections are really the purview of the states. And Ken, to take it one step further, isn't voter registration usually a function of the political parties?
It is a function of the political parties. And you are correct that voting and elections are the purview of the states. We run, if you think of the District of Columbia like a state because they participate in the presidential election and have their own, we have 51 different sets of rules. And that is a good thing. And I'll tell you a unique reason that's a good thing from my history working at the Department of Homeland Security. You know, one of the things that the federal government legitimately does is keep an eye out on foreign actors like Iran, China, Russia, to avoid and counter them attempting to participate in our elections in any way. But that's foreign actors. And the federal government is appropriately the vehicle to deal with that. But if one of them were to hack an election, just for discussion purposes, they would hack one state at most because of that we have all 51 different state systems. If you did what many of on the left want to do and centralize elections out of Washington, then if they hack the system, they've hacked the entire nation's elections. And they actually would be a much more serious threat to play a role actively in changing votes for presidential elections. Whereas now, because of the Electoral College, every state is its own separate election. And they don't know any more than any of us do which states are going to be the critical ones that are going to turn the outcome one way or the other. And every time they even try to meddle in our elections, risks getting caught. And above all, they don't want to get caught. And so we've made the value, if they succeed, low enough because of our state-by-state approach that it makes it too dangerous for them to try to directly hack our elections. Just one example that you don't hear other people talk about very much, but it's a Homeland Security perspective that I have as to why it is so valuable to have each state running its own elections, to say nothing of their own history, the laboratory of democracy, learning what works best, and so many other reasons.
So we have this executive order hanging out there, and we have federal departments tinkering in the election process, Ken. Senator Ted Budd of North Carolina is taking aim at bringing a halt to this. Can you fill us in on what the senator is attempting to do?
So this week, he had a budget amendment to the Senate appropriations. It's called a minibus. It's because it's one bill of many as opposed to one great big bill funding the whole government. And his amendment would have prohibited funds in that bill from being used to implement or to enforce that executive order 14019 because it isn't appropriate for the federal government to be doing. There's no statutory law allowing the government to do it, and he would block it by blocking funding for it. That's what Senator Ted Budd attempted to do. And he's not the first senator, by the way, to really drill down on this. Senator Hagerty and another dozen senators in May of this year, they requested a full accounting of all of the federal funding that was used to implement the executive order. Well, guess how much they've gotten out of the Biden administration? They haven't gotten any information out of the Biden administration on that subject. That alone, if I were a senator, would be a reason for me to block further funding.
As we look at this, we're now on the eve of yet another presidential election here in 2024. And Ken, there's still a significant part of the electorate that questions the integrity of the 2020 election. As you look at this ongoing tinkering by the federal government, and we see it by governors in individual states as well, is all of this contributing to skepticism about what the integrity might be of the election coming up in 2024?
Absolutely. And I lead a group called the Election Transparency Initiative at electiontransparency.org. If people want to check us out, that's electiontransparency.org. And our gold standard is confidence in the outcome by the side that lost. We want a system that is so transparent, so reliable, and by the way, that includes simple, that everybody can see everything that's happening in the system except how their neighbors mark their ballots.
Ken Cuccinelli is national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. Tell us a little bit about the background. Who all is involved? How did the Election Transparency Initiative begin?
So the Election Transparency Initiative is almost 3 years old now. It began coming out of the 2020 election because of the very concern you cite by many grassroots activists and ordinary citizens who were concerned that what they saw and what they weren't allowed to see in the election was so concerning to them that they needed to be actively engaged in fixing it.
Again, we have been talking with Ken Cuccinelli, the national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. Ken, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Always good to be with you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We had a number of key elections in key states around the country this past week, and Scott's going to give us the results and also talk about the impact. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's always great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me back.
Well, we had a number of elections around the country that some thought might be bellwethers for 2024, or maybe it tells us what messaging works and what doesn't. So let's go around the horn and start out in your home state of Virginia.
In the Commonwealth of Virginia, we had some really, really close, tight elections. Both sides were incredibly well-funded, and ultimately in the state Senate, it looks like it's going to be a total wash, and the Democrats are going to maintain their two-seat majority. We did have a decent outcome in some of these really, really competitive races. There's a race in Prince William County with a guy named Bill Wolf, law enforcement, and he only lost his race by 4%. That was, I think, predicted to be a much bigger defeat. So he sort of overperformed there, making it really tight. And then over in Loudoun County, Juan Pablo Segura had a decent showing, but still a difficult loss. He lost by 6%. So those were two of the big races that I think Republicans were hoping to win here in the Commonwealth. And obviously, the Democrats have a message that they're kind of sticking to, and they were incredibly well-funded, like I mentioned. Then you flip over to the House of Delegates. Republicans held a small majority there heading into Election Day, and it looks like it's going to be 51-49 for the Democrats. The fundamental point here, Lohman, is that these majorities are very, very small. Even if you just got one of these Democrats to change parties to Republican in both chambers, you would have ties. And so I think that everybody that's listening in Virginia and elsewhere where you have these close races, you have to understand how much your vote matters. You have to understand how important it is to actually get out there and cast your ballot and not be disgruntled, not be unenthusiastic about the political environment or whether or not there's various personalities that you disagree with. Policy is on the ballot, and these policies ultimately are voted on in our legislatures and determined by state agencies, and they impact our everyday life. And so I think what happened in Virginia was honestly fairly expected, just given the redrawn maps that we've had. I read earlier this week that Republicans actually won every race that was a Biden D+9 district or better, meaning if Joe Biden had only won by 9% or less, Republicans were winning there. And if that's going to be the situation heading into the general election for 2024, that's something that I'd love to see, because that means we're going to win a lot of races, because we know how tight these things can get.
Going a little bit further south, the governor's race in Kentucky was also thought to be somewhat a bellwether. But Scott, there you did have an incumbent Democrat. So what happened there?
Well, you just used the I word, incumbency advantage. We know that it's really, really difficult to beat incumbent governors. And what you had there was Andy Beshear, who is fairly popular in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Republicans did well down ballot, but Beshear won re-election by about 6% over Daniel Cameron, who was the attorney general there in Kentucky leading into the gubernatorial race. I think that there's still pretty strong enthusiasm for a voting bloc that wants to see a change. And to look at these races when it's 47.5 to 52.5 or 53 to 47, that's just a few people out of your community that you need to persuade to, number one, get off the sidelines, or number two, to change their vote, and we can win. And so I think that there's a strong message here when you talk about public safety and illegal immigration. I think that there's a strong message when you talk about Bidenomics and the socialist left and how far they're trying to really change the fabric of America. I think there's a message on parents' rights when it comes to indoctrination. I think that there's certainly a real opportunity for us to go after voters that feel disconnected, like nobody represents them. And, you know, I think there's an appetite for a lot of voters to just throw everyone out of office, even though there is an incumbency advantage. That's a close race for Beshear. He was up big just about a month ago, and that race certainly tightened as the spending sort of leveled out.
One state where the Democrats thought they might make inroads into a Republican stronghold was Mississippi, where, again, we had a governor up for reelection. What occurred there?
Yeah, I think some people were expecting a close race, but ultimately Governor Reeves won his reelection. I did see a post-election map that sort of was county by county and showed some areas in western Mississippi that are trending blue compared to the last election. And so I think it's just something for people to be mindful of. How does this sort of happen in these various pockets that are starting to trend? Is it because of an immigrant community that is sort of getting frustrated? Is it because enthusiasm among Republicans is dropping out? Is it because of parochial issues or local corruption? There's so many things that can dictate the way that voters feel when they show up and cast their ballot.
Well, we will continue to keep an eye on all of these election results and the themes and messages that played and didn't play with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is an organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if you want to learn about Club for Growth PAC and the candidates that we support, you can check us out at clubforgrowth.org. And you can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Voters defeated progressive ballot initiatives in Maine and Colorado. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Election Day this year was not exactly a must-see event, unless you live in Virginia or New Jersey or Kentucky, the three states that had important legislative and gubernatorial elections in this off-year cycle. Well, you may have forgotten that an election was even happening. But that doesn't mean there weren't interesting races on the ballot this Tuesday. And personally, I like these off-year elections because it gives us a chance to put a little spotlight on races that probably wouldn't get any attention at all in midterm years or presidential election years. And so this year, as often seems to be the case with that, that meant paying attention to a couple of weird ballot questions in Colorado and Maine, of all places. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and you're listening to American Radio Journal. And I know there were some higher profile ballot initiatives happening on Tuesday, especially in Ohio. There were a couple of really high stakes ones there. Voters in the Buckeye State approved one that enshrined the right to abortion and another that legalized marijuana. So much for Ohio being a swing state that is trending towards the right, I guess. But I don't want to talk about those things right now, because I'm actually more fascinated by what voters in Maine and Colorado did on Tuesday by definitively defeating a pair of ballot questions that were pushed by Democrats. Let's start in Maine, where the progressive left was pushing a plan to seize the means of electricity production. No, literally. Maine ballot question 3 would have authorized the creation of a new quasi-public entity to run the state's public utility services. The new Pine Tree Power Company would have been allowed to purchase or acquire, using eminent domain if necessary, the state's existing private electric production facilities and distribution lines. The new power company, the new quasi-state entity, would have been governed by a board that would have been a mix of appointed and elected members, and it would have been the first such statewide utility entity in the country, although there are a few examples of things like this operating on the local level. See, most of Maine is already served by a pair of investor-owned utility companies, the Central Maine Power Company and Versant Power. Advocates for the takeover, which included progressive groups like the Sierra Club and Common Dreams, said that they were going to deal a blow to capitalist greed by getting those two, you know, profit-hungry companies out of the way and replacing them with a public entity. Senator Bernie Sanders, who of course is from Vermont, not Maine, also had endorsed the ballot question. He had dropped into the state back in July to say that power belongs in the hands of the people, not greedy corporations. Although I think if you push the button in his back, that's just what automatically comes out. In reality, the proposal would likely have cost Maine's electricity consumers because the new utility collective would have had to buy out the two existing utility companies and take on their debt, and all of that would have come at a price tag of around $10 billion. According to the Portland Press Herald, that meant that ratepayers would have to cover an additional $500 million in annual debt service payments for the next decade or so, and all of those payments, of course, would have to happen before they got a single watt of electricity. What's interesting in the Maine case was how that kind of fractured the political left. Most notably, it was the Maine AFL-CIO and the local chapter of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Both of those unions came out against the proposal, including the IBEW, which actually represents the workers for the existing utility companies. They were against the takeover too. Now, residents of Maine can't be blamed if they want some changes in how their state's electric utilities operate. Central Maine Power and Versant Power ranked dead last in customer satisfaction within their respective categories in last year's J.D. Power and Associates rankings. But a state takeover is probably not going to solve that problem. Indeed, the best way to force those utility companies to improve would be to subject them to more competition. But ballot question 3 would have taken competition out of the equation entirely. It would have created a state-run monopoly and then just hoped for the best. So voters crushed the idea at the polls, and that's great. About 70% of the vote went against this proposal in Maine on Tuesday. Out in Colorado, meanwhile, Democrats were pushing a bit of a Faustian bargain on voters. They were promising short-term property tax relief that came with some scary long-term consequences. Proposition HH, if it had been approved, would have undone a key component of the state's unique Taxpayer Bill of Rights law, or TABOR. That law, passed as a ballot initiative back in 1992, limits the annual growth of Colorado's state government to a formula based on inflation and population growth. It's widely hailed by fiscal conservatives across the country as a model for forcing the state government to live within its means. As part of the TABOR law, Colorado is required to return excess tax revenue to taxpayers. That means the state can't run big surpluses that easily tempt lawmakers into expanding existing programs or dreaming up brand new ones. Proposition HH would have changed that. If it had been approved, the ballot initiative would have created a new, higher cap on how much revenue the state would be allowed to keep as part of its annual surplus. In return, taxpayers would get a reduction in property tax rates and some other changes in how those rates are calculated that might have provided additional relief to some homeowners. Basically, the state would have given taxpayers a small tax cut now and then kept a lot more of their money over the next few years. But voters saw right through that charade, too. 60% of Coloradans voted against that idea on Tuesday. Now, these exercises in direct democracy, they're always somewhat imperfect ways of setting policy, especially because turnout in these off-year elections are always pretty low. But even with that caveat, I'm pretty heartened to see these two results because these are two cases in quite different states, in fact, in blue-leaning states in both Colorado and Maine, but two examples of where voters discarded proposals that were simple but flawed solutions to complex problems. And so, you know, maybe policymakers in state capitals and Washington, D.C. will take note of that. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out the rest of our coverage of these two ballot questions, everything else that was decided on Tuesday night around the country, and of course, all of the ongoing issues in Washington, D.C. Find all of that online at Reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Since its inception, the left has attempted to water down or kill Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights. They have failed once again, as we learn from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Well, depending on your political persuasion, this week was either a major win, a horrible loss, or a mixed bag. But in cheerful news, voters in Colorado have retained one of the most important pieces of their state's policy environment. On Election Day, Colorado voters were asked to vote on a ballot measure with huge implications for the future of Colorado's Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, or TABOR. As I've covered many times before, TABOR is really the gold standard for state limits on the growth of government taxing and spending, and it puts voters and taxpayers in the driver's seat for those decisions in Colorado. Proposition HH was really a bait and switch that promised minuscule property tax cuts in return for substantial government spending increases over time, and the eventual elimination of tax refunds triggered by TABOR limits in tax revenue. Thankfully, Colorado voters overwhelmingly said no to Proposition HH this week by roughly a 60-40 margin. And TABOR still stands strong as the gold standard for state tax and expenditure limits, known as TELS. Passed via the ballot in 1992, TABOR has held spending and revenue in check by limiting the budget growth in Colorado to a formula of population plus inflation growth, and limiting the use of any new taxes and requiring voter approval of new taxes. As a result, TABOR has been a target of Colorado's progressives for years, and Proposition HH was not the first time taxpayers have been asked to be complicit in undermining their rights under TABOR. Proposition HH would have temporarily lowered the property tax rates paid by Coloradans, ostensibly providing small relief. However, because revenue at all levels of government in excess of the spending growth allowed by Tabor must be returned to taxpayers, a small rate cut like this provides little relief. More importantly, Proposition HH would increase what the state is allowed to keep and spend by 1% each year. While it may not sound like much, over the next 2 years, these changes would have allowed the state to keep about $500 million more than it otherwise would have and spent that money. In 10 years, the state could have potentially kept $2 billion more each year. All that money would come out of the Tabor refunds that taxpayers receive. State legislative staff in Colorado estimated that under Proposition HH, by 2025, Tabor refunds would have been reduced by 23%. In the long term, they may have been eliminated completely. And of course, that was the goal of Colorado progressives from the start. Tabor has seen no shortage of these progressive attacks over the years, which really serves as an acknowledgement of how dangerous it is to those that would like no constraints on government's ability to grow. Though all states except Bernie Sanders, Vermont, have some sort of a balanced budget requirement in their state law or their constitution, most don't have robust protection on the growth of state spending, which Tabor offers in Colorado. Taxing and spending may not be out of control in Colorado right now, but it would only take one future generation of policymakers to change that. In Colorado, such a generation of big spenders has been kept at bay so far by the resiliency of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. As my friend and former state representative Patrick Neville put it, Tabor is the only thing keeping us from becoming East California. On Election Day, Coloradans said no to Proposition HH, just as the latest example of voters rebuking attempts to undermine or eliminate Tabor. In 2019, a similar Proposition CC proposed allowing government to keep more of Colorado taxpayers' money, and Proposition 3 CC was ultimately rejected 54-46 by voters as well. Other states would be wise to look at Colorado's Tabor as a model for restraining future generations of those that would like to overspend or not to be accountable to taxpayers. In 2010, Colorado ranked second best in economic outlook in the Rich States, Poor States report that I co-author with Art Laffer and Steve Moore. Colorado now ranks 25th in economic outlook due to more than a decade-long standstill in many important measures. Other states move dramatically in the direction of cutting taxes and becoming more competitive. If not for the protection that Tabor provides, it's likely that spending and taxation would be out of control in Colorado today. It would begin to look more like the states that people are continuing to flee: California, New York, Illinois, just to name a few. Colorado has an opportunity to continue to move the ball forward, and voters sent a really important message, an essential message across the nation, that when people focus on common sense, kitchen table issues, and good government economics, that's a winning message across the country. For more information, you can go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXBR-FM in International Falls, Minnesota, KTIA-FM in Des Moines, Iowa, along with WWSM-AM in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.